Welcome to the House of Surgery, a podcast brought to you by the American College of Surgeons. In this series, you'll hear from and about surgeons in all specialties, in all practice configurations, and in all locations. Their success stories, advice, challenges they've overcome, and words of inspiration as they serve their patients with quality, integrity, and professionalism, and strive to heal all with skill and trust. This episode features Dr. Tracy Hull, a colorectal surgeon from Cleveland, Ohio, who gave the Apkarian Lecture at Clinical Congress 2023. In her lecture, Things I Wish I Had Known at the Start of My Journey, Dr. Hull shares 10 important career lessons, including publishing early, getting the right mentor, putting family first, and finding your niche. The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and not necessarily those of the American College of Surgeons. Enjoy the program.
I am very honored to give this talk. It's a big responsibility. There's people in the room of all different levels of their careers, and you know, I'm hoping to give a message that touches each of you. So I really take it very seriously. I've known Dr. Apkarian my entire professional career. The first time I really had an interaction was when I was going to take my oral boards in Chicago. I had a baby that was 2 months old, and so we stayed at my husband's aunt's house so he could watch the baby, and we drove in from the western part, and we got a flat tire. I'm like, my husband's driving me, and I'm like, I cannot believe this. We have a flat tire. I am going to be late. This is before cell phones, before any of that. I had to call the hotel. They had to find him. He was so gracious. He said, I remember it so distinctly. Oh, honey, don't worry. We'll put you at the end of the day. Now, that was wonderful. I was still a nervous wreck, and I passed. But that was my first interaction, and I thought, what a kind man. Because, you know, he could have been, you know, a real jerk and said, oh, well, you've lost your chance. So this is Dr. Apkarian, and I believe when he's a medical student in Cook County. And this is with Dr. Olga Jonasson when she was, a relatively new staff. Look at that look on her face. I don't know if he's presenting or what, but I only knew her very peripherally because I did my medical school training at Ohio State, and she became the chair after I had left, and one day I introduced myself to her, and she was very lovely, but I don't think I would want to see that look on her face. It looks really austere. And as we discussed, his daughter is a colorectal surgeon, and I think that if you asked him, he would feel that's one of his really great accomplishments, is to inspire his daughter to be, you know, following his footsteps in colorectal surgery. And we're lucky to have her here today in his stead. So this picture on your left is Dr. Lavery, who is one of my mentors, me, Dr. Apkarian, and Dr. Church at one of the meetings. And then you can see on the right, he is the second from the right over there. So he was very, very influential at meetings. And the things that I remember most about Dr. Apkarian, he was never afraid to speak his opinion. We would be on this panel, and people would be saying things out of the textbooks, and he would just say, you know, that's really bull. That really doesn't work. And it was what everybody in the room was thinking, but he would just say it, so it was great. So for this talk, I have no disclosures. So when I'm thinking about this talk, I'm thinking back to when I first became a staff, and this is our department. The people in the back were the fellows, and the people in the front were the staff. So as you can see, I am the only woman in this whole sea of men. And at that time, I was seeing patients and operating, and I said yes to everything. If I look back on my career, what I should have been thinking was, how do I progress? How do I achieve mobility in my professional society? Those were the things I wish I would have been thinking back then. And then I think I wish I would have been thinking, what are my short and long-term goals? I was speaking with some medical students yesterday, and I was asking them what their goals were, and they really couldn't articulate it, and I think that's really important. And this, to be able to get where you want to go, you have to know. So I think that was one of the shortfalls. So that's why the genesis of my talk. So the first lesson I learned was about publications. If anybody ever talked to me in depth, they would know that I feel I'm about 10 years behind the men, because it took me about 10 years to start to really publish. And this was my first real significant publication, 2002. So I'd published a few things at the Cleveland Clinic, but really had not published a lot. And I can remember still distinctly driving home at night in the 90s thinking, because I had this great database, I should be publishing, I should be writing. And somebody said, well, maybe you weren't a good writer. That wasn't the problem. I didn't have the time. I was an okay writer. I'm not as good as some people, but I'm an okay writer, and I just was not making the time. I was probably seeing too many patients. And then this article came out, or this was published in 2009, and these were two articles that really put me on the map in my society, and people kind of took notice that maybe I had something to say. So it took me about 10 years. So if anybody ever asks me, I say, you got to publish earlier, you got to think about it, you have to make time. I think it's really important. There's always something you can publish about. So whatever you have in your area where you are practicing, there's something that's unique to that area. And people will say to me, I have nothing unique. Oh, yes, you do. Tell me about your practice. Tell me about what you do. Tell me about the medical students or the residents. There's something that you can really make a difference about, because all of us have something unique to our practice. So my second lesson, did I need a mentor? So I kind of had some built-in mentors. I was really lucky. But yes, everybody needs mentors, and mentors are different than coaches. And I'm going to talk about my mentors. These are some of them. So Dr. Fazio was the chair, and he was a very, very famous colorectal surgeon, and I really did benefit. I remember when he said to me, so he was from Australia, and he said, Sheila, because all the women are Sheilas, and I don't know what the men were, but I was always Sheila. And I'd say, my name is not Sheila, and he'd go, you're Sheila to me. Okay, whatever. So he'd say, Sheila, you need to do this, you need to do that. And it was really, a lot of times I'd think, oh my God, not another thing to do, but it was really beneficial, and he really promoted my career. The second person at the top is Pat Roberts, and when I was more junior, she struck fear in me, because she is, you think I'm like this, she is really like that. And she was the second woman president of ASCRS, and she set a lot of things in motion in our society that then I had to pick up the pieces on, because huge, huge changes that were wonderful, but she really helped guide me through those, and I still call her for advice. Dr. Church, who's the next person, taught me how to do research. I went to the Cleveland Clinic and had done a little research at Ohio State, but not a lot, and then I did my surgery residency and did none. And so he really taught me how to write a paper, how to do research, how to think about doing research. David Schatz from Lahey Clinic is the next person. You might say, how do you know David Schatz? So about 2010 or so, I realized David Schatz was in his office at 5 in the morning when I'm in my office. And if I had a question or was asking, needed some personal advice, I would text him or send him an email. Are you in your office? Yes. I call him, and he, a lot of mornings, he would just say to me, no, you shouldn't do that, yes, you should do this. So, you know, that was really, I was really impinging on him a couple times. He missed meetings because we were still talking, but he really gave me a lot of excellent advice. The person that really set me on my leadership course for ASCRS is David Billingham, that's on the lower left. He was the president of ASCRS, and he called me up one day. I can remember exactly where I was standing in the Cleveland Clinic, and said, again, before cell phones, he had to call into my clinic, talk to my secretary, had to get out of a patient's room and talk to him, so it was a little bit traumatic. And he said, would you like to be on the executive council of ASCRS? And I'm like, and I didn't even really know what that meant. What a big honor. And I'm like, well, I have to ask Dr. Fazio. So I have to ask my dad. So I asked Dr. Fazio, that's what I felt like. So I asked Dr. Fazio, and he said, really? Are you sure they mean you and not such and such, one of the men in our department? Seriously, that's what he said. And it kind of pissed me off, actually. So I called Dr. Billingham back and said, absolutely. And that's what got me started in my journey in the Executive Council of ASCRS to president. That was in the 1990s, and I was just president in 2020, so it takes a long time. Dr. Stephen Wexner still is very much a promoter of my career, and I thank him constantly because he still puts me up for positions and supports me. And then Dr. Lavery. Dr. Lavery was the silent, strong type at the Cleveland Clinic. He just worked, He gave you his honest opinion about things. He was always, always ready to help you if you needed help. And in fact, he's retired. And recently, I had a problem in the OR, and I called the first person who didn't answer, so I called him. And he answered, he goes, oh, what do you need? I said, I need help. I'm going to FaceTime you what this belly looks like, and I want you to tell me what you would do. And it was almost what I was going to do, but he gave me a few tips. So these people are really important to keep in your lives. Family. I was just at a session before this on women in leadership or some title like that, and I thought it was very interesting because they talked about putting family first, but in a lot of their actions, I didn't feel they put family first. And that's a mistake I made. And how do you put family first? So you rely on your partners. You have partners for a reason. And I can remember, my son is 30 now, but I can remember that he had plays that he was in. And they, of course, are Thursday and Friday. And, you know, Friday's my OR day, Thursday was my clinic day. And I missed both of them. Well, I got to the Thursday one, but late. And as I look back, and he still reminds me of this. I mean, you know, come on, this is 15 years later. So it did make a big impression on him. And he said at the time it was okay. I do feel guilty. You can tell I feel guilty. And so interestingly enough, I could have asked my partners. They would have covered. I know they would have because I've covered for them. But you got to think about that. And I think you have to thank your family. My husband gave up his career for mine. And, you know, sometimes I don't thank him enough. I do a lot of things now with my son that I think I do because I feel guilty, but I also like doing things with him. He's very intellectual. He looked at this talk and said, Mom, you got to up your game. It's not, you could make it a lot better. I said, thanks, honey. And then I am the caregiver for my sister who's mentally challenged, and she lives in our household. My husband helps take care of her. So you got to pick the right partner, but you also have to thank your family, and you have to be very appreciative. My parents, who my father's deceased and my mother is in a facility, both of them were very, very much workaholics. My dad was a veterinarian, and I grew up with his vet practice closer than that door away. And we were expected in the morning to get up, my sister, who's mentally challenged, and I, to get up, clean dog kennels, feed animals before we ever went to school. And I played basketball in high school, and I had to work my chores around basketball. So there's a lot of things that I had to do to really balance my time and really be smart about it. And I think that makes a big difference. And I really regret that I never thanked my parents enough for the upbringing I had. So when you have the opportunity, thank the people around you that made it happen. Get a second degree. So my whole early career, the men in our department were getting MBAs, right? And I said to Dr. Fazio, I would like to get an MBA. And he goes, no, you don't need one. And I think it's really important because I'm at the, as somebody said, the last nine holes of my career. I don't know where I am exactly in that. But there's a lot of things at the Cleveland Clinic that I can't do because I don't have another degree that really make a big difference. And I think that, and I heard somebody talk yesterday about, in a session that Dr. Ellison was chairing, he retired, was bored, probably when he was about 70, he went back to school and got a PhD. I don't think I'm gonna do that. But when you're young and you have a lot of energy, get that second degree. It's really, really important. And you don't think about it now, but it really is important. Develop a niche you're really good at and be an expert at it. And I think you can do that in anything that you choose in any area of surgery. So in case you haven't noticed, I'm a woman. And pelvic floor was usually felt to be a women's problem. And I did my extra year with Dr. Fazio doing redo pelvic pouches. I thought I was going to be a pelvic pouch person initially at the Cleveland Clinic. But all the women patients would come to me and talk about their pelvic floor problems, and then I noticed that rectovaginal fistulas were really a lot more complex than the textbook said, and I developed this humongous practice of really women's disorders in colorectal surgery. So what about rectovaginal fistulas? Because if you Google me, that seems to come up. And you know, they're a misnomer, they're really anal-vaginal. And when I started, everybody did rectal advancement flaps. And this was the premier, one of the premier textbooks, there were others, Gordon and Navat Thong, when I was first starting. And if you look at this table out of their textbook, the success rate for advancement flaps was, for rectovaginal fistulas, was, you know, 70 to 100%. I thought, as I was having failures, what planet did these guys come from? Because, you know, these are all men. Well, Anne Lowry is a woman, but these are all people that were at great programs, and they're reporting this, and I'm like, there is no way. So the first thing that I learned is be very afraid of these fistulas because they never do what they're supposed to do. And when you look at your results, the top left is ours, the bottom left is Cleveland Clinic, Florida. You can see that rectovaginal fistulas and advancement flaps, about 60%. And Florida and Cleveland published the results almost simultaneously in the journal in 2010. And then if you look at all types of fistulas, like even men with fistulas you do a rectal advancement flap on, was only 79%. So where were they getting that information in Gordon and Navat Thong? And what were we doing wrong? And as I thought more and more about it, and we did more and more ultrasounds, for all those of you that don't do ultrasounds, you can see that the thing in the middle is the probe. The black, the next big black thing is the internal sphincter, and the next white thing is the external sphincter. Anterior is towards the top, and you can see there's a break, there's a defect. And a lot of these were childbirth injuries with no muscle anteriorly. So Dr. Fazio, I didn't come up with this operation. Dr. Fazio came up with this operation. I just used it a lot. So I would take these women to the OR and unroof these fistulas and make them into a fourth degree tear type situation, and then close the muscle and close the anoderm of the rectum. And it would look like this at the end. And lo and behold, we had better results time and time again than we did the advancement flaps, 78 versus the 62. And not every patient was this applicable for, and we all are in agreement who see rectovaginal fistulas that we've probably shamed the obstetricians into doing a better job of repairing tears and second and third degree types of lacerations. So there's not as many that have no anterior muscle. However, you know, that was my niche, and I really used that very aggressively to promote my career. Take a leadership course. So a woman named Brooke Gerland joined the Cleveland Clinic in pelvic floor in about 2004 or 5, and she had way too much energy. She said, we're gonna take these great leadership courses that they have at Case Western Reserve, which was down the street. And I'm like, yeah, okay. Every year we're gonna take one. And she said to Dr. Fazio, we're gonna take these leadership courses. And he said, oh, that's a good idea, girls. And so we took these leadership courses every year. There were three of us in pelvic floor, three women, Maserat Zucci, Brooke Gerland, and myself. We took these leadership courses. Never did I think I'd ever use it. I learned about emotional intelligence before it was a lexicon word, right? So but I would look at what we would learn and I would say, okay, this male partner likes sports. So, and it taught you a lot of different things about how to deal with your people around you, right? I'd use it on my husband too, actually. And, but anyhow, one of my male partners that I could never get him involved in what I felt he needed to do. So they said, well, you know, appeal to their interests. So every morning I would listen to the sports scores, and then when I had to have a meeting with him, and when I would see him, I'd say, can you believe the Browns traded such and such? I had no idea what I was really talking about, but it didn't matter because that opened the door. Honest to God. But I do know a lot more about the Browns because I've kept up a little bit more. And but I would say, you know, it would have been like most recently, this was way back, you know, but I would have said, you know, can you believe we bought Deshaun Watson to Cleveland, you know, and he would have like lit up. So, you know, other players way back when, Bernie Kosar, somebody like that. And it completely changed the trajectory of how we interacted. It was marvelous. And we were on this committee, and we worked together on the committee. So I used a lot from the leadership course. So I know the college has a leadership course in April at Washington, D.C., and I'm sure it's excellent. I have to tell you with a little bit of disclosure, I am on this committee for this leadership course for ASCRS that's in February. We had one last year. This one's even better if you went last year. Come this year. If you sent your younger people last year, send your people again this year. Completely different. Sharon Stein is the overall head of it, and she has done a phenomenal job. So take leadership courses. It really changes. And you're not too old to start taking leadership courses, because little things like situational awareness, little things that are now in our lexicon, they're important in the OR. They're important to hear what's going on, for instance, in the OR, because then you find out that your scrub tech, you know, their child's sick, if you're listening, and it makes a big difference how you interact with them that day. We are all leaders. If you think, I'm not going to be a leader, I'm not going to be a leader of a department or anything like that, no. We are all leaders. And as I like these things that, these different sayings, it's an action, not a position. We are all leaders. And I always think that these 10 things that I got off the internet are interesting. And it doesn't require any talent, right? Be on time. Have a good work ethic. Put your best effort forward. How is your body language? I'm terrible at that, because you know exactly what I'm thinking. So my brain can be thinking, you know, really bad things, and my body will just tell you. So I have to really work on that. Even if I don't have a lot of energy, try to have energy for the people around you, because they are your patients, especially when they're going to sleep, expect you to be have a lot of energy for their case. Have a good attitude. So I could be absolutely irritated at the world, and I try to hold my patient's hand every time they're going to sleep in the OR and have a positive attitude. I can remember the anesthesiologist had really ticked me off because we were having a discussion about something, and he was not buying in. And I was trying to figure out how I was going to convince him that, yes, we needed to do this and this for a patient after one going to sleep. And I took a hold of the patient's hand that was going to sleep and smiled and acted like nothing was wrong. And the patient sent me a note afterwards and said, that meant the world to me. That's a little thing. And, you know, I think we owe that to our patients, and it doesn't take a lot of effort. Have passion for what you're doing. If we're not here, we're not having passion. So I think that's a given. Be coachable. Take criticism. I think for my generation, it's very hard. Our medical students thrive on targeted areas of improvement, which is basically, to me, you know, what am I doing wrong? And it's a little bit difficult sometimes to do that in our jobs. Doing the extra thing. There are a lot of things I've gotten ahead of by being just doing that little extra thing for somebody before I was asked to do something that I really wanted to do. And be prepared. It doesn't take much to be prepared. And you might think, oh, it's really hard. In this day and age, it is not that hard. We need to be prepared. So I'm going to talk about some of the things that have changed. So one of them, when I started, diverticulitis. So when I started in the early 90s, after the second attack, if you were over 50, you got surgery. After the first attack, you got surgery if you were under 50. And we operated on people, and I think we scared them. We said, you don't want a colostomy, do you? And so then we found out that the first attack is usually the worst, almost always. And after recovering from the first attack, your chance of having to have a stoma is pretty low. And so if we were operating with that premise, we would be doing at least 10 to 20% of elective colectomies that don't need to be done. So we need to consider the individual patient, the comorbidities, the severity, all those things. One of the things that I think has happened, though, is our pendulum has swung the other way. I've never had to use bone scissors for diverticulitis like I have in the last probably 5 years, because we have this new mantra, okay, you can have these small little diverticulitis flares and you don't need surgery, you don't need surgery. And eventually the patient really gets tired of that and wants surgery. And they've had so much fibrosis in that area, I've had to actually call the orthopedic department, not department, but go to that section and get their bone scissors. So there's a lot that we still don't know about diverticulitis. I think that you have to really, really base everything on the patient, what the patient's goals are. And I think that we should not be afraid to operate on it, though, because if they're having multiple flares and it's interrupting their life, we should be operating on it. I've seen people that have had 50 flares in 2 years, and the surgeon said, oh, you really don't need surgery. Put yourself in the patient's spot. So we're surgeons, right? So we'd say, oh, we want surgery because we don't want to have to give up our clinic time or change our OR schedule when we have diverticulitis. Well, think how the patient feels. Another area that's really changed is rectal cancer. So this was a really highly quoted study in the early 1990s. So the NIH had a consensus conference, and they recommended adjuvant post-operative radiotherapy with 5-FU for patients with essentially, you know, stage 3 disease. Number one, we don't call it the Duke stage. We have a little bit more scientific way of looking at it. And now we do things so differently. So our surgical technique has been modified. We know that we have to get into the mesorectal plane, the correct plane, and do a total mesorectal excision. We know that adjuvant therapy up front, patients do better. We have MDD conferences and we discuss it. That would have been heresy, you know, way back in the 1990s. Watch and wait. That's just become an okay thing recently, right? You do total neoadjuvant chemoradiation and there's no cancer that you see and you're not going to operate. You know, we all thought Dr. Habegara was nuts, but she's, you know, about 20 to 40% of those patients you never need to operate on. And immunotherapy, you know, not every patient is right for immunotherapy, but the patients that have MS unstable, those patients respond quite well. You know, the woman from Memorial Sloan Kettering that published those 14 patients last year that 100% responded, that is miraculous. We need to find more treatments for all of the rectal cancers like that. But that was never even thought of. I remember being in the early 1990s thinking to myself, okay, they have better chemotherapy for all these different cancers. When the heck is colorectal cancer going to catch up? So we're catching up. And this is TNT, this is a meta-analysis of 28 studies, and they found that patients had a pathological complete response in 22%. In TNT, that was just with pre-op chemo radiation, and TNT increased it to 39%. That's just amazing. That I would have never fathomed that when I started. So this is the thing that now is on our doorstep that we have to be wary of. We have to be wary of young onset colorectal cancer. It's heartbreaking. We have a whole service line for just young onset colorectal cancer and all of the things that it you know leads to. These are people under 50. And some of them are in their 20s. We just had a woman that presented with rectal bleeding after she had a baby, and she has stage 4 rectal cancer. And she had bleeding throughout her pregnancy. Somebody could have done a digital exam, for God's sakes. Oh, no, it's hemorrhoids of pregnancy. We got to think around those things now. It's predicted that by 2030, 25% of the rectal cancers we are going to see, a quarter, are going to be people less than 50. So we got to think about this differently. Colon cancer has a similar trajectory, but not quite the same. And most of these cancers in these young onset folks are in the left colon. So we have to go back to thinking about at least doing flex sigs. And the really scary thing is these cancers are different. The study from the National Cancer Database looked at 43,000 patients. So if you are old, like me, and you have your cancer, and you're treated according to the National Comprehensive Cancer Network guidelines, you have a 14% survival benefit. If you're less than 50, it doesn't matter. It doesn't change anything. And in fact, those patients may even do worse. So why is this different? Is it a biologically different? Is it because we use more antibiotics, herbicides, obesity, gut microbiome, variations in MSI, because there's more MSI in the young onset versus our older patients? I don't know, but we need to be thinking about this, and we need a different way. It's alarming. Matt Kalady wrote an opinion piece on this, and he hit it right on the head. We need to be thinking about this differently. Our recommendations for younger patients should not be the same, and we need novel treatment regimes. And so this is what the young people need to be working on. So sometimes you just have to stop and smell the roses. I have to say that when I was driving in the dark when I was young, I never thought about, oh, it's fall, the trees are beautiful, anything like that. I never thought about that. And I've really changed as I've gotten older and think about those things. And I think it's important to start that early so that you have that better mindset. I think you have to eat well. This is a cliche, but, you know, we don't eat well, right? We're in the OR, we don't eat well, we are at functions at night. You have to think about that. Getting enough sleep, I struggle getting enough sleep. I used to be able to sleep standing up because I was so sleep deprived. I'm not quite that bad anymore because I don't take as much call. But I could seriously sleep standing up. Exercise, I was very good about exercising until I became president-elect of ASCRS, and then all the time I had to devote to that took my exercise time. I think you have to quit worrying about, you know, what's perfect, what's your, you know, body perfect, your clothes perfect. You have to think about what you have inside you. You want that to be perfect. And if you don't like who you are, you have to change. And I think that that is one of the hardest things to do. And you have to change, and it's little things you can do. You don't have to be like overwhelmingly move, but sometimes it does take that. And then the last thing is ergonomics in the OR. I was pleased to see that there's a whole booth downstairs that in the exhibition hall that's devoted to it. My partner, Anna Spivak, that's her passion. She is always honest about ergonomics. I don't do robot, but she's talking to the people when they're doing robot. You know, you're not right. Your ergonomics aren't right. She's coming in yelling at me, you're not standing up straight. So I've changed a lot of things, so the tallest person in the room gets to decide the table height, parallel, and then if I have to stand on stools, fine. It might be the medical student, but I think we have to really think about that. The other thing that's interesting is shoes in the OR. So my feet were always killing me. By the end of Fridays, that's my OR day, I could hardly walk down the skyway to my office, and somebody said, well, you need to go to this place and have your feet evaluated and get a different pair of shoes. Yeah. So finally, that was probably in February. So finally in July, I couldn't stand it. So I went to this place on the next day, which was Saturday. I actually called this friend and said, hey, by the way, I'm at this place, and I'm taking your advice. And she goes, oh, I'm at the grocery 2 doors down. I'll be right down, because I know you won't do the right thing. She knows me well, right? She's a pediatric GI person. So they measure your feet. I walk around. They bring out two of the ugliest pairs of tennis shoes I've ever seen. They are so ugly. And she said, only one of these. She goes, these are the only two that will fit your foot type. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, they are so ugly. And they cost so much money. And she looked at me, and she knew what I was thinking. She said, shut up and try them on. So I tried the first pair on. It didn't feel quite right. And they were the cuter pair. And I tried the second pair on, and they are so ugly. And they are pink and blue. That's not me. You can see I wear a lot of black, pink and blue. No. So I try them on, and oh my gosh, my feet felt great. I'm like, okay, put your vanity aside. So I bought these shoes, and I paid a fortune, and they have made a big difference. My hips and knees, my feet. I have turned everybody on in the OR. I should get a commission, actually, because I've sent at least 16 people to this place, and they have bought ugly shoes like mine, so I'm starting a new trend, right? So the worst part is I got blood on them, because, you know, sometimes you get blood on your shoes, even though I had booties on. And I called the place up, and I said, can I wash them? Oh, absolutely not. That changes something in the fabric of them. You can't wash them. So, you know, I took them home and hosed them off, and I thought, oh, my God, and they still look bad. I have to wear my booties everywhere, because if a patient saw them, they would be really nervous. But take care of your feet. It's really important, and it doesn't take a lot. All right, so my last lesson is that I learned from Dr. Fazio is a good surgeon reacts to the present, a great surgeon plans 10 steps ahead. And this is something I really aspire to when I'm teaching the residents. So you're doing, for instance, you have a sigmoid colon cancer that's obstructing, and you want to do a stoma. You have to do a thoughtful stoma. Don't do a stoma way up in the descending colon where you're going to need that colon to come down. You're going to have to then do a retroileo when you eventually do your resection. Do something thoughtful. Think, okay, the next surgery I'm going to do, probably I'm going to do a left colectomy, and I don't want my stoma to interfere. Or don't do a distal transverse colon stoma. You got to think about that. I can't tell you how many people do colostomies and really then send the patient to me for whatever issue they have going on, and then they burn a bridge. So really think what you're doing. It's really, really important. Crohn's disease is another great example. That poor patient's going to get another operation in their life unless we come up with better, we have much better drugs, but we need even better drugs. So think about when you use a stoma site and how you use it. And it's true in other specialties. I remember as a resident in Syracuse, the pediatric surgeons would put a Hickman in and tie the vessel off distally, and I'd say, what happens if you need to use that vessel in the future? And they'd say, oh, that'll be the adult surgeon's problem. No, it should be all of our problems, and we have to think about it. So I want to thank you for the privilege of your attention and the honor of giving this lecture. I truly am honored to speak at a lecture that is honoring Dr. Abkarian. He has had a huge influence in my life and in the realm of colorectal surgery, and I'm sure beyond. So again, thank you, and thank you for attending.
Thank you for joining us on the House of Surgery podcast, brought to you by the American College of Surgeons. If you like this podcast, please rate it 5 stars and let your friends and colleagues know about the podcast. On social media, use the hashtag #HouseOfSurgery. You can learn more about the American College of Surgeons, its members, programs, products, and services at facs.org.